Hello, everybody. Welcome back for another episode of TFT Study Hall. I'm your host, Frodan.
And I'm Dish Soap.
And we are back for another episode on today, May 16th, 2024. And today is a big day because we also get a B patch for the 14.10. And it's about dropping in like an hour or so. So why not spend the next hour predicting and reviewing the previous patch while looking forward to the next meta?
For sure. I think recording on Thursday is probably a pretty good idea for this podcast since they fetch on Wednesday.
Yeah.
Stuff to talk about.
We can react immediately to, you know, what's happening and then kind of drop some of our thoughts on some of the big winners and losers of the patch. So let's go ahead and dive into it. This is the big tournament patch that's happening in the next weekend or two. There's going to be a bunch of tournaments happening. So this is a competitive staple patch. At least it should be. How do you feel like your first impressions were? You streamed all day yesterday. What's your first impressions of the patch?
I think it was okay. My biggest gripes with the patch was not like stuff being strong. Like I think Lilia and Syndra being above the rest was like whatever. Like they definitely need to be nerfed. But my biggest issue with the patch was actually like Aisen stuff being too weak and Kayn being too weak. I feel like they kind of got overly nerfed. And it kind of threw the meta in a weird spot.
Yeah, it feels like the patch was just a symptom of what's been holding back the TFT team for a while, right? There's some pros. There's a lot of pros, actually, let's be very real, about why TFT is good to be on the League of Legends client. We get a bigger player base. I think that's the most obvious one. But there's also like a lot of access to engines and skins that they don't have to port over and a bunch of advantages of why they can make so many sets a year. But the limitations of having to anticipate the meta 8 days in advance, because back then, right, Kayn and Kai'Sa with Fortune was like really dominant. And then as the patch played out, we not only saw Kayn get weaker because people were finding more counters to it, but then like Syndra popped up in Dryad, and that was not even addressed by the patch whatsoever. So a lot of people were complaining and saying this is going to be one of the worst patches ever because it was just going to be a Syndra lottery. Although I don't know if that ends up being true necessarily. Maybe because people were just avoiding it. I don't know. It's kind of weird. I was watching some streams and people were just not playing Syndra that much.
Yeah. I mean, I went to like hour one into the patch with the game plan of not trying to play Syndra because I thought it was going to be super, super contested. And then when I got actually into the games, I realized it wasn't that bad. You could just play it. I think the biggest thing stopping it from being a Syndra lottery was the fact that they buffed Lilia. They made her targeting like insane. I kind of joked that they gave her an aimbot. They're like all of her orbs just fully locked onto people. And then, I don't know, it's such a DPS increase if you're not like missing anything.
Yeah, she spent a couple hours in Kovacs. Now she all of a sudden hits everything. And I mean, the thing about Lilia's orb is that part of the reason why the DPS was so hard to measure is because she was hitting oftentimes just one target. And if she hits multiple targets, it's not exactly a double DPS increase because of the way the orb spread damage, but it's a lot more damage, especially on that final cast, if she's able to get big bursts going. So Lilia, the big winner of the patch. In fact, we saw multiple variations of Lilia pop up. Which one's your favorite?
I mean, I think the Sage version was like kind of cool, where people weren't playing Vertical Invoker or they weren't playing with Ashe. They were kind of playing it in a similar shell to the Sylas comp, but instead of like the whole Bruiser story of her setup, they had like a 3 Mythic Core with Lilia.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was pretty interesting. I don't know. I don't think Lilia's boards are like that cool. It's like 6 Invoker, it's Mythic, it's Ashe, and I guess there's this new Sage one. There's a lot of them, but I guess Sage was the most interesting to me.
Yeah, she's surprisingly flexible with what you can build out, and she's also good in some of those other reroll compositions. If you're playing Kog'Maw, she's now going to be a very reliable late game DPS increase for your board. Or if you're playing Nico Hero Augment, I talked about it last episode, how one of the biggest sleepers could be things like Drop Blossom Nico. This patch definitely seems to be the case because of how much better Mythic is, how much better Lily is. The only downside is I think that a lot of people are playing Nico now. It's just hard to hit. That might be the biggest drawback of that. We talked about some of the biggest losers of the patch being Kai'Sa. The 4 trick shot nerf was so heavy-handed. They are changing that in the B patch. So now the B patch, it went from 60 to 50 and now 50 to 55, if I recall correctly. Do you think that's where it should be good enough, or do you feel like this is not enough for trick shots?
It wasn't just the trick shots that hurt her. It was like the biggest thing is like the Bruiser frontline nerf.
Ah, yeah. Galio.
Yeah. It was like my opinion and a lot of other opinions that like the Bruiser frontline already like wasn't even the best frontline in the game. So treating it equally to others in the nerfs is like, I don't know, to me, it's a little off. I don't know. If Galio gets like a tiny, tiny buff, I think the line comes back, especially for Fortune.
Yeah, and it's one of those critical mass things because just a little bit extra tankiness allows Galio to withstand a little bit more. And because Kai'Sa's so burst-oriented, trick shots are just so burst-oriented in general, you're able to turn the tides of the fight. I mean, you looked at what happened with just like a little bit of HP buff across the board and just made a lot of these forecasts oppressive. And all of a sudden, the small nerfs across the board it might end up just making Galio pretty bad. The stats on her are pretty terrible. Kai'Sa is averaging a 4.8. Making her one of the worst units in the game, period, to play. Not even just four costs, straight up.
Yeah, the weird thing is, like, I've actually had a few successful games with her, but I like, wasn't playing anything close to, like, the old board. I was playing in, like, Ghostly and Ink Shadow setups. I don't know if it was Kai'Sa or the other stuff, but I've seen her have success, like, outside of the four trick shot variation. So,
yeah.
Wonder how that develops.
Okay. Now, we've seen Ornn get nerfed in the main patch, and now we're going to nerf him again alongside Syndra for the B patch. So that should theoretically take it down, and I think Mortdog was talking about how the power of Syndra and Dryad and Faded was how good the frontline was stalling for her, and it's also anchored by the fact that mid-game, there's units like Thresh giving you so much HP alongside Yasuo. Do you agree with that? Do we think that that's actually the case here, or is Syndra the problem herself? Because we are nerfing her as well.
I think Syndra was definitely part of the issue. I don't think it was all on the front lines. It was all the front lines' fault. I think Syndra's ability to burst down pretty much any front line, any melee threats, made their comp a little oppressive. But I think Ornn in particular was definitely a factor.
Yeah, and just also the Dryad scaling just gets out of control very, very quickly.
Yeah, the like aha moment for me of to why the Dryad version was better was I realized that it let you pair Syndra and Ahri and not have to pair Ahri and Thresh, because in like the Arcanist version, you often had to pair Ahri and Thresh because you didn't have the frontline. But if you have a four Dryad Ornn, that's your frontline covered. So you get to like full invest in the damage.
And then all of her orbs scale off of the AP and it just gets kind of crazy. It might look relatively innocuous, 60 to 50 damage. If you just look at it at face value and not really think about anything else, it's like, okay, it's like 10 damage, but it's 10 damage per orb and it's scaling, and also just the percentage of which it's being cut is pretty significant. So I'm worried that Syndra ends up going the opposite direction where all of a sudden she became a really powerful piece of play around, and now it feels like you can't play her outside of very, very specific scenarios, which is kind of where she was at the beginning of the set. And I think part of it was the fact that Syndra is not also very good in other setups. Like, she wasn't very good in Arcanist, for example, which I think we talked about before, right? The frontline with Arcanist is just really awkward, right?
Yeah, the Arcanist board just doesn't work. I don't know. The board just doesn't work. You need like a three-star, like a Moomoo three-star Laoi, or you have to be playing it from such an ahead spot. I don't know. I just think the board doesn't work. I don't think comps that rely on being level 7 work.
At least not right now, unless it's like an all reroll lobby or like Zoe odd level portal or something like that.
Yeah, for sure.
Let's talk about Ashe and Wardens. That is another comp in the S tier that's performing well, and it's specifically around the vertical sniper aspect of Ashe, because a lot of the sniper trait got buffed at 2, 4, and 6, and now a lot of people are taking things like Sniper Crest and Sniper Crown, which this is not a fact or fiction, but I just want to put it out there. Sniper Crown is the best performing augment that isn't just straight up a hero augment on 3-2, which those stats are kind of fake. So if you take those out, the best performing augment in general right now is Sniper Crown. I guess we can start like a little preview. Is that fact or fraud?
Oh, that is completely fact. It doesn't like win every game, but it's like the Sniper Warden board is like by far the cheapest meta board right now on level 8. And it just saves you lots of HP on stage 4 and stage 5. A really, really easy top four farming comp.
Yeah, and it's exactly, going back to just the previous point, it's exactly what Arcanist was lacking, right? Because cheap, efficient frontline is what helps keep you stable, because now all these ones and two cost units that normally are just going to get bulldozed by like an any one are much more resilient. And I hope that that actually ends up applying to things like Behemoth as well, right? Part of it is that Wardens are so good now and efficient because of all that damage, that damage reduction. Also, by the way, Spirit Guardians, that augment that gives it's kind of like a weird lifelink between the Wardens. It also gives how much extra bonus DR? Let me go ahead and look it up. 12% increase.
Yeah, it's not the worst effect. It's just it used to like average really, really poorly, because it doesn't really do that much if you're only playing two of them. But when like a 4+ warden metacom comes up, I think the augment's actually pretty good in a setup like that with more than 4 warded.
And it gives you a Moomoo, which is,
yeah,
it gives you a Moomoo and Gnar, which is like, kind of look at some of these augments. There's some really interesting discrepancies between the gold version and the prismatic version, where some of it just gives you like 5 gold of units and the other just gives you like a 2 cost. It's really interesting. It's really interesting. Mm. There's a new comp also that we put in S tier, probably just for the hype. I'm not entirely sure if it's going to stay here. Ghostly Zyra is the new AP reroll, and you have other things you can also roll for as well. Some people, for example, choose to go for Zoe 3 if the game is leaning towards that, and then you play Zoe Ghostly. Do you think this comp is for real, or is it all just hype?
I think it's for real. I kind of described it as like the child between like Senna reroll and like the Janna Zyra Story Reaver setup. You take the Zyra like Story Reaver setup and then you just add 4 Ghostly instead of playing all like the Dragon Lords and stuff. It just ends up being a lot of damage. It's like the best way to make your Zyra pop off.
Yeah, my experience with it is that this board is also hyper efficient, as in it's also really good at being stable at 2 stars to help you push level 8. I've even seen people fast 9 off the board where they play 4 Ghostly, Zyra 2, Zoe 2, and then they just play like a random upgraded 4 cost. You know, maybe they hit like Silas or something. And then all of a sudden they're just fast 9, transition to a fast 9 AP board, right? Hui, Irelia, Azir, and then win the game. In fact, that's like, I think I saw Sasuke do a couple times as well on his streak of like incredible first. He went like 1-1-1-1 into 1900. By the way, are you two racing the 2K, or is that just, is that just you both happen to be in that striking distance?
We're not really racing. The thing is, we're like, both of us are convinced that LP gains right now are like really, really inflated. I got like, we were both like losing less than 20 for fifth. Both of us lost like 47 for seventh. If we're getting plus like over 30 for first, it's kind of crazy. I'm used to like minus 80 from seventh.
Minus 80.
Yeah, so we're almost losing like half as much LP as we're expecting.
I saw you take an eighth. I think you were playing Lucky Paws Kabuko, and someone contested you by accident as well. I think you both clicked at the same time. You lost like 101 LP. You're still saying that that's low?
Oh, that was like before this patch. I think like this patch it's inflated.
Oh, okay.
Like the past like 2 days.
Hey, you know what? The history books is just gonna remember who hit 2K and who didn't. So we take those.
No, they're already putting an asterisk.
Okay.
It's a Mickey Mouse 2K.
I guess you just gotta hit 2100 then to compensate for a 22. We'll see.
Yeah, maybe.
Okay, so that's our meta analysis. Let's talk about some of the other things about the patch. Last week we talked about all the new artifacts and support, or at least we tried to. This week, I figured we revisit that discussion because we buffed a whole bunch of new artifacts. I count like 12 or so, and some support items to try and get the balance closer. We didn't nerf some of the really overperforming ones. People were talking about Suspicious Trenchcoat, all the crazy combos. Some of them we discussed last week in the previous episode. This week, I wanted to see about some of these new artifacts. Have any of them impressed us since the patch dropped?
I was already like, before the buff, I was actually pretty impressed by this item when I like generated it randomly off of like the 6 random artifact encounter for 1 round. But Horizon Focus, if you have like a Rek'Sai opener, is like insane. It just gives you a bunch of like, it pretty much gives you like Vow equivalent stats. And then it'll like you solo frontline the Rek'Sai and then it just stuns everyone. And then their frontline just has 30% less HP. And then late game, the best holder, I think, is Nautilus. You just use it as like a Vow. You stun people. You do a chunk of magic damage.
Wow.
Force down stuff like when you have like Lilia.
And that stacks on Ionic Spark and Shiv as well. So if you have like a Spark holder, maybe you give Spark Horizon Focus or just at least have it near it. And then all of a sudden it combos and does a huge 30% of their max HP. That's a lot of damage potentially in the late game. You're talking about scaling damage with Horizon Focus. Nice. That's a good one. That's a good one. Another item that's also performing really well that's basically around that same tier is Unending Despair. This one's a little on the boring side. It just gives you the ability to convert the shield damage into like a miniature AoE. This one just goes on your generic frontliners. Is there any specific combo with Unending Despair that you either thought of or seen?
It's like a 10 streak with a Laoi opener. It's not something you really want to take later in the game, but it's something to consider a lot if you have a shield unit on like 2-1s, especially. I think it's like really, really strong for win streak and tempo. And the effect is like kind of irrelevant late game. Just think of it as like a tank item. But early game, it's really, really powerful, I think.
Okay. I like that. I like that. And the stats do kind of replicate that as well. Kind of a lower win rate, but a pretty good average placement indicating you really want to curve out for tempo. In the meantime, we've discovered some of the other combos. If you missed the previous episode, we talked about, you know, suspicious trench coat. Really good. Probably bugged. I think it is bugged on, you know, getting a bunch of stats so you can put on Udyr. Wit's End on Bard. Mittens on your melee carries. Forbidden Idol on Tahm Kench. What about some of these other ones? Blighting Jewel. People have been wanting Teemo to be really good for a while. Luden's Tempest, potentially really good on Overkill, or maybe just good on Lilia. Fishbones getting buffed. Are any of these, you know, Lich Bane, Curse Vampiric Scepter, Prowler's Call, do any of them impress you at all?
Not really. I think they're just like, they're not like terrible. Like you just take them. I think Prowler's Claw and Vampiric Scepter are also like still like super, super niche. One interaction I want to shout out, I learned this from Levluck, is Blighting Jewel is the nuts when you have Tattoo of Toxin because it procs your magic effect in additional time. Like if you have a dot champion, you're like doubling the dot effect, which is kind of crazy. The setups to look out for it is like you're playing like Ghostly Kai'Sa or whatever, and then your first Ink Shadow is Toxin. So if you see a Blighting Jewel, you can just play like a Morgana duo carry and have like Toxin Morgana just kind of go infinite.
Whoa, that is wild. Okay, very specific, but I'll have to try that out. I feel like maybe if it's like an artifact anvil start, maybe you could think about that.
Yeah, like artifact anvil portal into first tattoo is toxin.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, let's talk about support items now. We've covered most of the artifacts. Had the buffs changed anything in your mind? They buffed Eternal Flame, Vow, and Spite.
The biggest thing is it made the support dummy quite more takeable. I was avoiding that augment like really, really hard previously because I think there was like a lot more low rolls, but now I think it's okay. Outside of that, I don't really think it changed that much. Just made the worst items slightly less worse.
Yeah. Now the worst performing support items are Zephyr, which is surprising to me, and Unstable Treasure. I played a Wandering Sentinels game. And I got Unstable Treasure, Needlessly Big Gem. And that was a really, really hard game. Still some pretty terrible combos. Please stop voting for that portal, that PSA.
I don't get it. There was a game I played today, top three were all Moonstone.
Oh, God. It's just the hazards have not. Some people just get a free like stage two and then you're just basically playing down 40, 50 HP. It's wild.
Yeah, that portal is like crazy to me that it like exists and people vote for it.
If you guys want some tech, Duelists with Find Vintage. We made a note of this on our guides on TFT Academy as well, but Find Vintage still is alive and kicking. And one comp that utilizes it really well is Duelists due to the fact that they can utilize like a wide array of all the support items ranging from just generic buffs to specific things like Banshees and now Knight's Vow being better. Eternal Flame also ends up being something that people are picking a little bit more often. In China, apparently, one player always picks Eternal Flame and kind of turns Duelists into kind of a scaling comp, which was really interesting. I'm not sure if I'm entirely sold, but just some food for thought. People are experimenting with the different support items. Don't just gravitate towards the usual ones. And if you do have a spot for it, that could be some powerful tech to help you gain LP.
As another note, I expect Duelists to be like significantly better next patch, like after the B patch. I think the Syndra matchup might have been the worst matchup in the game for Duelist. Like it might be like the lowest win rate like matchup in the game, just like out of anything. Because the Syndra could just burst all of your Duelists and then your Tristana jumps to the other side of the board and then they kill the Tristana. Like the Syndra kills the Tristana. If you see less Syndra, I expect Duelist to be like a lot better.
I played one game of Duelists, actually. There's actually a couple of one trick Duelists on ladder right now, which is really interesting. Just food for thought for people who want to climb. But I had Lee Sin with Edge of Night with a Not Today augment, still getting basically bursted in the first 10 seconds of the fight before Lee Sin can fully ramp up and get like all the Duelist and Titan stacking when he hits critical mass and it becomes difficult to deal with. Then just bursts him, just way too much damage. Completely destroyed.
He does not care about your infinite healing guy.
Okay, so that's a really good cover of the meta. We'll be back next week to do a more in-depth analysis of what changed and maybe talk a little bit about the tournament meta of how it affected things. In the meantime, let's head over to today's Fundamentals 101 topic, which is, as voted on by our viewers, strongest board. People want to know how to play strongest board at all phases of the game. When a lot of times when other people are asking what strongest board, or you're saying like they're not playing strongest board, can you just like define that for anybody who's heard that for the first time?
I think the name speaks for itself. It's generally like the strongest board you can field based on the shops you like have seen naturally and the potential items you can slam and the potential synergies you can play.
Mm-hmm.
But often like you still have to think about econ. If your strongest board on say like 2-5 makes you like go below 10 gold, it's probably not worth it, even like if it's a decent spike.
Yes, yes. So an example that Disope might think about is if you have ability to play like a one cost bruiser, but there's like a three cost bruiser in your shop. The strongest board is probably that three cost bruiser, but it costs you econ. And we talked about last week the importance of making your first gold. That could be like an example of you're not playing your strongest board, you're playing your strongest board within the confines of making sure your macro strategy is on rails.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk a little bit about strongest board dynamics, and we'll break it down to three phases: early, mid, and late game. So I think the first thing that people talk about with strongest board is just playing upgraded units. You just want to play two stars over one stars. A lot of times people favor synergies a little too much. Unless the early game synergy is just so broken or so valuable early, like Fortune, you have to play Fortune. That's part of your quote strongest board of that dynamic. When is an upgraded unit better than a one star unit for synergy, Dishope?
This is like a very hard question to answer. Usually it just comes down to, at least for me, playing the set enough, knowing what synergies are powerful, and also like knowing what units do. It's really, really hard to like make like a rule for this when it's like just dependent on everything. Like for an example, in like a story over setup, it's possible your strongest board, like if you're playing around like the Sivir, Riven, and Garen, it's possible the last unit you want to play is a Teemo. For the like the trick shot. It's also possible that you need some more frontline. So you might want to play like a bruiser or a warden. It depends on like what unit that is. Depends on the star level. And it's possible you want to play like a, I don't know, like a two-star Yasuo or something for more frontline as well. It kind of just depends on the strength of the units and stuff. And it's really, really hard to make like rules for this stuff. I'm mostly just doing it based off like personal experience and lots of repetition on the set.
That's totally fair. And I think you're a strong learn through intuition player. One thing I think is really helpful in general is always keep in mind what you think is a good mixture of defensiveness and offense in the early game. I think in the early game, people think a little bit too much just sometimes about like the synergy bar or like, do they have the perfect items? But maybe even just thinking about just a straight up, like, do I have damage and do I have a tank or frontline to get in the front, the way of things?
You definitely, the first priority was getting like a decent front line. You don't want to be run over in like 1 second. So usually that just comes down to having like one upgraded unit in the front, at least probably getting their synergy activated. And then the second thing you want on your board is actually just pure single target. AoE in the early game is pretty irrelevant because you're not going to be able to capitalize off of backline damage until you get through the front line in the early game, at least. There's no like critical mass of backline damage. There's not that much of it this set. But for example, something like Lux is like super, super low prio in the early game.
Yeah.
Because she does like backline damage and you have to like stall for her a while before she gets anything done. Whereas, for example, something like Zyra like will always just focus on the front line. Ahri and Zyra and stuff.
That's actually a great answer to one of the questions I was going to bring up later, but we can just go ahead and tackle it now. Part of our Q&A, either on Spotify or Discord, people are submitting questions all the time. Warrior Sentinel asks, how do you evaluate a character's effectiveness in different stages? Like Darius being good in stage 2, but Morgana being bad in stage 2, excluding the cost affecting econ intervals. I think part of it is what you just described, which is that the effect of something like Morgana is AoE, and AoE is scaling based off number of units. Well, guess what? The weakest AoE will ever be is at the beginning of the game, because there's just not that many units you're hitting consistently. Versus the single target is hitting more percentage of their team, right? If it's 3-on-3, Darius is taking out one of three of the units, and that's way more effective than slightly draining all three of the units at the same time, if you even hit them.
At least this set, it might be different with like a different pool of units in the future, but in this set, stage 2 is when the melee is like the best, because usually the enemy team can only field 5 units, so if you have any type of healing, it's pretty easy to just out-heal whatever the enemy can throw at you. But once you go into like stage 3 and people can play 6 and sometimes even 7 units, there's definitely a lot more like focus fire and burst damage. So you can't really like out heal it. until you get to like the forecast and stuff. So that's kind of why Darius is like still even a beast on stage two right now, even after the nerfs. But like as soon as stage three hits, it's kind of hard for him.
Yeah, front lines are weaker also early game. So when they start getting 6-7 online, they have not only better units on average stage three, but they have more synergies. You're playing Kha'Zix 2 carry. He was doing so good. And yeah, he doesn't do anything at 3-1 anymore. So definitely been in those spots before myself. Do you have any heuristics for tier evaluation? This is another question, which is, you know, for example, is a 3-cost 1-star better than an upgraded 1-cost 2-star or even a 4-cost? Is a 4-cost 1-star better than an upgraded 1-cost unit?
I don't think I have that many. For 4-cost in particular, it's like 1-star 4-costs are better than 2-star 2-costs.
On average.
Outside of that, I'm not really sure where to evaluate like the like 1 versus 3 and 1 versus 2, stuff like that.
Okay.
It's probably just comes down, at least for me, to like a unit by unit evaluation.
Fair enough. If two units look close in power, are there any tricks you use to help decipher which is better in the immediate? We're still talking about early mid game here.
I would usually just like ask the question of like what I need on my board. Usually you're not evaluating like purely like frontline versus frontline or like DPS versus DPS. Usually it's like, do I need like this tank synergy or do I need this like extra bit of backline? And then I would probably just ask myself like, what am I struggling with more? And then you could probably make your decision based off that.
Yep. Or another way you can think about it is playing around your star unit. Let's say you're in a situation where you start off with early items and you have like 2, maybe 3 item on a specific unit, like Ahri early game. She's very good. How do you best support her? So if you're looking at 2 units that are kind of close in power, which is just straight up better, if one of them adds just raw DPS, is that as valuable as adding something that could help shield install a little bit longer for Ahri since you have DPS already solved? Kind of going back to what Dijon was saying, but maybe looking directly at your star units and thinking about how to make them more effective. Then final question for early game, then we can move on. How important is it to play strongest board while trying to lose? If you're trying to either, you know, lean into lose streak or you're trying to straight up, you know, play Fortune.
Usually pretty important. If you're playing stuff like Fortune, the prio was like losing every single fight. So it's a lot less important then. But if you're just playing like a generic setup, saving HP is always going to be good. And you never know, like winning a fight randomly, especially if it's like before Carousel or something, isn't even that bad. A lot of times you can like spike and play for like a 2-streak or something. But generally, if you think you are going to end up loose streaking anyways, you probably are going to prioritize making econ intervals, like maybe not holding every single possible thing, maybe only holding the essentials and prioritizing econ over the strongest board, but not like trying to lose, for example.
Yep, that makes sense. That makes sense. And I think if you aren't preserving HP enough on your loose streak, especially if you're playing things like What Doesn't Kill You or other loose streak oriented things, Scoreboard Scrapper, just watch some good players who do play it and you'll see some of the difference. They preserve just enough HP to give them maybe even an entire life or two. And that gives them all that buffer room to make those massive comebacks.
Yeah, like a trick I've been doing for a while that I also like, I don't see nearly as many as people doing it, is trying to like snipe one unit in the early game. Like if you know your board is weak, the best thing you can do to save HP is just killing like one unit. So like fully indexing and damage and putting like everything on the same side, like even like on top of each other, trying to kill like one unit is a pretty good way to save like one HP per round, and that stuff adds up.
Love it. Love it. And I think those are small little tips that you can always pick up either through things like this podcast or just watching streams and videos. You'll always see small little nuances like that to help gain edge. Let's talk about mid game. Mid game strongest board is some of the hardest things to do in the game. I think this is actually what even very top challenger players get wrong all the time. And that's usually indicative of whether or not people know when to roll at level 6 and level 7, know what they're rolling for, and how to evaluate their board. I don't actually have much questions I even can write down because I feel like it's just so abstract and free-flowing depending on even the augments and encounters, stuff like that. So do you have any just general approaches to mid-game strongest board to unlock the power of either your carry or your frontline or whatever board you're playing?
Usually you just want to be enabling whoever you have items on. If you have a bunch of frontline items, probably want to get like both of the frontline units traits activated. If you have a full like 3-item backline carry, same thing with the backline. Yeah, I don't know. It's a very, very abstract and situational question of like mid-game board strength. At least this set, one of the strongest setups is like Ghostly still. In the mid game, at least. And like also other strong setups are I mean, just like honestly, just allowing a Moomoo like insane in the mid game still, especially after the Warden buff. It's like really, really hard to make Hero 6 and guidelines around how to play the mid game, because it's one of the, I think it's like the least explored aspect of TFT. The good thing is like it sounds like kind of daunting. Like if I can't tell you how to play it, like you might feel worried that you can't play it. But the thing is, even at like top challenger, the vast majority of people just skip the mid game and fast forward to level 8. So in your games, you're probably fine to do the same. if the idea of playing the mid game scares you.
Yeah. When you say skip the mid game, you just mean like don't roll, just whatever, buy your shops, get your carousel items, and then just like get stage 4 as healthy as you can. I think the thing about mid game in general that, and this kind of goes a little bit into other concepts, is that the strongest mid game players don't really have rules to when they play, because they understand sometimes you roll, sometimes you don't. Sometimes you level, sometimes you don't. Sometimes you slam items, sometimes you don't. And it all kind of depends on the context of how strong your board is.
I don't know. It's really, really broad of like a subject. It's really, really hard to give a like valuable short feedback.
Okay.
Without, like any like examples.
So how about late game then? Late game strongest board. A lot of times people struggle with this a lot, especially capping their boards higher. So how do you generally approach determining what is a stronger version of your board late game? There's so many different things you could do. So many synergies or units you could roll for. Or you just hit this random five cost one star, this legendary unit. How are you determining it, the best board in that spot?
I'm still doing like the same evaluations I kind of always do. But the thing is, like, a lot of time I don't have to like wonder about what I should aim for, because a lot of people have already done like the legwork for me, as in people make meta comps, optimize meta comps. Generally, I'll go into a spot looking to play a meta comp and knowing like what like 2 to 3 units I can splash around and play around with, based on like whatever I've upgraded and whatever like 5 costs I hit. Yeah, just playing meta comps and knowing like the 2 to 3 flex slots every comp kind of has.
I think to that point, as you're playing more, late game requires more reps. And part of what makes late game so daunting for strongest board is that you just see fewer late game scenarios than you do early mid game. So people are just naturally weaker at that because they don't have as many experiences going through it. But try to survive to late game. That's step one, to get better at it, because then you start seeing the stronger boards that beat you. And the second thing is kind of going back to what we were saying before, which is try to evaluate each role of what your units are trying to do, right? If you hit a Lissandra, what is this Lissandra actually doing? Is she stronger than replacing another really powerful utility unit? I think it all has to come down to understanding what your board is trying to do. What is your win condition? Always go back and think about, how am I winning the game?
Yeah, that usually just comes down to just knowing the optimizations of the certain comps. That's definitely where stuff like statistics come into play. I'll trust the stats on stuff like for Porcelain versus for Sniper over like my own intuition a lot of the time. Often it's really, really hard to know exactly what certain traits are offering.
Yeah, and just a note on that, we're probably going to eventually do a fundamentals talk about stats in general, but I want to preemptively get ahead of it. Some people just hear the word stats and they roll their eyes. Yeah. And they think, okay, well, you're playing with stats. That's boring. That's whatever. That's lame. That's less skillful, whatever. They have like all these different things they want to say about it. But the one thing I want to say about stats is stats are just showing you history of what other people have done and giving you information based off that. You're effectively playing with other people. One of the most profound things that Clear TFT has ever told me, he's you guys never met Clear, don't be in too much in a rush. This guy is quite the character and he's got quite a big ego when it comes to playing TFT. But one of the most profound things he's ever said to me, you can't play TFT by yourself. And if you're playing TFT by yourself, you're going to learn slower, you're going to execute worse, and you'll just be a stunted player. So a lot of people, you know, have friends or they watch streams, but for people who don't do any of these things, you can look at stats, and stats in a way is just like playing with other people. Other people have done it before you, learn from them, improve on that concept, and use that to improve as a player.
Okay. Definitely deserves a more deeper dive in like another episode.
Yeah. For sure. For sure. Okay. Last question about strongest board is, how do you evaluate if you lost a fight because the board is stronger than yours? If, let's say, you're VOD reviewing your own game Is there anything that you are looking at to say like, okay, his boards are stronger than mine. I can't beat it. I did the best I could. Versus like, man, my board probably could be better with all these different combinations.
First thing I look to is see if I position correctly. That's like the first way I would evaluate a fight. Because if you don't position correctly, a weaker board can beat a much stronger board, say if their carry just dies for free. So I'll look to like positioning first. Like, is my tank getting focused? Is my DPS surviving until the end of the fight? And if the answer to that stuff is yes, then I'll look to see what happens. If I lose the fight because like something heals too much, say like I can't burst in a moon before it heals up, I can't kill like a BT Darius before it heals up, I maybe could have looked to see like, oh, could I have played more damage here?
Mm-hmm.
If my frontline falls over too early, could I play more frontline? Just seeing how I lost the fight and then what my options were.
I like that. All right, so we tried our best to tackle strongest board. I think it was okay. This is a really hard fundamental concept. Maybe perhaps something we should evaluate later in TFT's life cycles. Because I think one thing that stood out to me was you said mid game is still really unsolved. And I think that's like the same with a lot of different strategy games in general. Even chess, mid game is ultimately where people are still trying to make a bunch of gains at the moment. So we're pretty bad at TFT overall, currently as a player base in this early life cycle. I think we're only going to get better at learning what strongest board is over time.
Yeah, it's definitely something that's like, this is a concept better explored through like a VOD review than like talking about it abstractly, I think.
Okay, fair enough. We tried. All right, we did this earlier before, so why don't we just jump straight into it then? We got fact or fraud. So I'm going to throw out a sentence and Dissoap basically gives his opinions fact or fraud, and then we kind of chime in and weigh our opinions here. So the first one is Xayah is currently averaging 4.33, putting her around the same tier performance as most 4 cost, except Galio and Kai'Sa, because those are really poor. And even similar to 3 costs like Alun and Soraka. Fact or fraud, is Xayah that bad? She's basically the same value as 3 costs right now.
Definitely fraudulent. The thing about like overall unit stats is like it's all about context. The context with that is that people are probably playing like the old 4 bruiser setups, 4 bruiser, 4 trick shot setups that got nerfed really hard. And like she did get a 5 AD nerf, but for example, I'll look at her and then she has a 77% play rate with Galio. It might be like an issue that like her frontline's dying too fast. Maybe if you play her with like the Ornn frontline, maybe if you play her with like the Annie frontline, she could perform better. If you play her like a 2 trick shot legendary setup, she probably performs fine. I've seen that definitely still work this patch.
Yep.
The context of it is 80% of her stats are with the 4 bruiser, 4 trick shot setup. That setup got nerfed really, really hard. So if 80% of your games are with a bad comp, your stats are going
to
be bad.
That makes sense to me. Nothing more to add to that. Okay, number 2. Portable Forge AVP is now even worse after a bunch of artifact buffs. Last patch, it was a 4.7, and this patch, it's still before the B patch, but I don't anticipate the change very much. It's now a 4.75, so it's now worse. Is that fact or fraud?
I still think it's fake. I think this augment is, and artifacts in general, are still good. It's just, on average, people haven't figured out how to use the items, and I don't think all the items are bad. It might be like slightly worse than it used to be. Because there's nothing more situational artifacts than just full generic like the pool used to be. But I still think Portable Forge is a strong pick.
Okay. I think that it's still best early. I think another thing worth noting is that Portable Forge becomes increasingly more risky the later the game goes, just because you're spending the entire augment for something that could completely miss for you. So just something to keep in mind for anybody that's, you know, can't help themselves, because it is a fun augment. I think that's part of the reason why some of the stats are bad, is because a lot of people are picking it from spots they shouldn't be. Right? They're skipping a gold augment that they could get instead.
Oh yeah, I didn't really think about it. I thought you were just referring to only 2-1, because that's like the mindset I have with that augment. I wouldn't really pick it on 3-2 or 4-2 unless like you needed a third item for a carrier or a tank.
Yeah. And maybe you're open to playing all different kinds of setups still, because you have like Morello Slam and that's it. You can still like open it into anything. Okay, number 3. Story Champion is now the best hero augment in the game, currently averaging a 4.0 flat. For reference, Lucky Paws is currently second at 4.05, and then Drop Blossom, Ethereal Blades. I'm not counting them at 3-2, because those are the best augments period in the game. But for obviously contextual sample size bias reasons.
I Don't know. I'm looking right now. It says Lucky Paws. It says Lucky Paws is better.
Oh, is it? Let me see. I took this last night, so maybe it's actually changed.
Yeah. I mean, they're both very small sample size, relatively.
Okay, maybe it's because I sorted by Diamond Plus. Okay, yeah, you go to Masters Plus, Lucky Paws is a little bit better. Okay.
How about this?
New factor fraud. Lucky Paws is the best hero augment in the game, averaging a 3.9. Even better than Story Champion and others. Is Lucky Paws, do you think, factor fraud, best hero augment in the game?
Okay, like, I don't think this is bad, and I didn't think it was bad previously, but I last three times I've taken this, I've gone 8th. I mean, I haven't taken on a new patch. They did buff Kabuko's mana, so maybe it's still good. Like, obviously, the overall stats like it, so it probably is still good. I think I have a personal bias against it.
Yeah.
With Story Champion, I think that augment is, like, really, really strong in Stage 2 and Stage 3.
Yep.
But I'm skeptical it scales into late game at all. Okay. At least based on, like, personal games against it. So I'd be hesitant to say if it's, like, the best one. I'd say, like, in my opinion, I think Shen is probably the strongest one. But the caveat is that if you're playing against someone rerolling a ghostly setup, you will probably not hit Shen, and then it's sad.
Yeah, that's the thing about these two costs hero augments that I'm having trouble with, is that Shen, Yorick, Nico, these are units that might end up getting taken from other comps. I like I said, I was playing a Nico hero augment reroll where three people hit Nico 2 in stage 3, and I just realized I couldn't do that anymore. I just had to push levels, and that's where it ends up being limiting. But I will say the one cost, people aren't really contesting you unless you're Dish Soap on stream somehow. I will say also about Story Champion is that the variations of it are changing. I think people are now trying, instead of playing like a Story Weaver setup, I think people are trying 6 Warden Garen. And I think that's been impressive because they buffed Wardens a lot. And if you're able to get to set and get set to scaling and play just good scaling backline, say Aurelia, for example, or someone else, you can actually win games that way with Story Champion. So I don't know if anyone else has given it a try a lot, but I've seen it do well, and I think it might be some back pocket tech that maybe people have for the upcoming tournaments. Who knows?
Yeah, I definitely think it's good. I've just personally seen it fall off like Gabe and go forth a lot, which is fine.
Yeah,
like, that's still good.
The one cost reroll, you can't really ask too much more than top 4. Asking it to win games might be a little bit absurd.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, last factor fraud. Competing against Masters players is harder at times than competing versus Challenger players. This is in light of the upcoming tournament this weekend, which people are posting their lobbies and showing that there's, you know, Masters, maybe even Diamond players in their upcoming tournament lobbies.
I've like made this joke a lot of the time. It's not actually true. It's not actually easier to go against Challengers than Masters players. But what I will say is it's like easier to predict what they'll do, which has it has its advantages. Like, I can say pretty confidently I'll be able to scout, like 90% of Challenger people's boards on Stage 2 and figure out, like, what comps they're trying to play. But Master player, like, might just pivot into a comp randomly, and I can't really play around that. But it doesn't mean, like, it's harder to play. Like, it doesn't mean, like, I'm going to perform worse in a Master lobby, because they're going to be doing other stuff worse, like Econ, Strongest boards, stuff like that. So it's not actually harder. It's just, like, sometimes they're just unpredictable.
Okay, fair enough. You forgot one important thing that you mentioned. They'll pivot randomly into your comp. Yeah, it doesn't matter what spot they have. They could have, you know, blue buff and archangels, and all of a sudden they pivot into Lee Sin or something like that. And then they're like, yeah. Me duelist out of nowhere. they are unpredictable and wild. I mean, I think that this is half fact and half fraud. I think there is an element of some people being better at playing against weaker players than stronger players. I think that's definitely true. And in fact, that's been kind of a hallmark of some players who particularly very good on like ladder, and they haven't really put on tournament results. I mean, it's been times where people accuse you of being, which is like, Dish Soap is good at ladder because he can beat the news, but can he actually go up against top challenger players? He's since, of course, dispelled that many times over, but that's definitely a thing. Like, some people are much better at capitalizing on other people's mistakes. And if other people aren't making mistakes, they don't really have edge. And it feels like they're just basically at the mercy of whether or not they're hitting that day.
Like, when you know you're in a weak lobby, you can just go 9 with like all 1 stars. And it's like the best feeling ever. But like then sometimes you'll get like baited to think you could do that in the strong lobby. So it's definitely you definitely have to put like context on.
I'm not sure if this is entirely right, but this might be similar to how people say like exploitative poker, for example, like trying to learn how to beat up on just weaker players. But if you know, I know a lot of people might play poker and be like, "No, you're wrong." So I'm not a good. I don't know anything about it really. But I've heard through my friends who have played, it's something similar to that. So
I think that's a decent analogy.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. All right. It's pop quiz time with Dissope, where, you know, we went over a lot of different concepts and stuff that he did know, but does he know everything? And I love doing this. So I'm going to throw out a random question. Some will be multiple choice. Some of them are open-ended, and we'll see how many he gets right.
Right.
First is, what is the worst performing unit in the game? What is the worst performing unit in the game based on the average placement? And we sorted by Masters Plus.
It's a trick shot. I don't know if it's... Okay, it's not Kai'Sa because she was like one of the worst.
It is a trick shot. I'll give you that hint.
It's one of the low-cost ones. It used to be Bard, I think. But I don't think it is Bard. Because like someone might high-roll their like Ord item and play like Wits and Bard. And then that might like open up a few. I think it's Sivir or Teemo. It's just the... I mean, Teemo, like, I don't think Teemo was bad. Like, they buffed him. Teemo 3 is actually pretty good. But, like, given the fact that he's, like, oh, but the thing is, I don't like Story Over that much. Like, Story Over Sivir is probably pretty bad. I'm just going to go Teemo and just, like, say Fortune, like, Fortune Tax, like, all the Fortune units, like, average bad. So I'm just going to say Teemo. But it's either Sivir or Teemo, I think.
Oh, you are so close. It is Bard. It is Bard. He averages over a 5. And the second worst is Teemo. Very close. Very close. That's so surprising to me that Bard is even averaging worse than a lot of the Fortune units. Very close for question one. Let's go into question two. Tome of Mending, this is the third green option for Kale, got buffed this patch. Where does it rank in raw AVP relative to Tome of Swiftness and Tome of Power? Those are the blue and red options. So give me the order of the 1, 2, 3. What's 1, what's 2, what's 3 in terms of best to worst?
1 is blue. It's always still blue. I feel like Tome of Mending has to have like the smallest pick rate in the game. I know from experience that the red kill is actually awful, like the third red one. So I'm just gonna say what's blue first, green second, red third, just because the red one is awful. But I don't actually know if it's worse than green because I've literally never seen green. But I think wow.
Almost bang on, exactly down to the T. It is blue, then green, then red. So Tome of Mending, for people who don't know, every 7 seconds, revive the strongest ally that hasn't been revived yet at 50% of their max HP. This is the 7 Story Weaver. I have yet to pick it once. And you are right. Yeah. Out of all the possible items in the game, it is the second rarest thing possible behind Radiant Eventshroud, which is called Equinox. So rare. You'll see every other Radiant item way more frequently than Tome of Mending. So nice job, man. Have you ever felt like there's a spot you could take it? Because the average placement of it isn't bad. Here's the thing about it. It's a 4.2 with a pretty decent amount of stats. So when would you take Tome of Mending, if ever?
The reason it's awkward is because like you need to take it when your board is good, but like the Story Weaver board isn't good by default. You need the Kale to like do a bunch of your damage. I just don't think it makes sense. Like if somehow like you have like all 3-star Story Weavers and a bunch of legendaries and like maybe like 2 Story Weaver emblems, maybe then. But I would still be surprised if it's not just blue Kale, so you can get a bunch of burst damage at the start.
Yeah, I don't even know if there's like crazy combos with Tome of Mending and Suspicious Trenchcoat or something like that. I don't even know if that's actually a thing, but it's so underexplored. Who knows? Either way, yeah. The stats indicate that you should probably try it every now and then. Maybe not just so if he has too much at stake with LP and tournaments, but for anybody out there, please let us know. Be our guinea pigs. Okay, question number 3. Radiant Morello, speaking of items, Radiant Morello Nomicon has been nerfed and is no longer the highest AVP Radiant item. What is?
Oh, wait. I remember looking at it this morning. It might have been like the second best. I remember looking at it this morning. I was like, it was a Radiant portal. I was like, wait, what's the best Radiant stat? And then I looked. It's like, oh, it's Morello. It's still good.
It's still good. You're right. But it's no longer the best.
I think they nerfed Red Buff. It's probably like TG or Spark. I'm gonna go TG. I don't know. It's either TG or Spark.
Ah, very close again. It was Spark. TG is good, though. You basically named 3 of the top 4. The other is Radiant Deathcap, is also very, very good.
Yeah, I think they buffed that one. Mm-hmm. A note about Morello is apparently, I mean, we talked about this on the last podcast, like we were talking about like the burn nerf. Apparently it's still 3% and it just says 2%.
Oh.
And that's why it's been good this whole time.
Oh, no, it's just a literal text error. Okay.
Yeah, it is still just 3% burn.
All right.
So it's still really good.
That's incredible. 50% buff. Okay, we got a couple more. Golden Remover in the most recent patch now has been added to stage 4-2 augment choice. Before, you couldn't get it as stage 4-2. According to its own average placement, is it better, worse, or the same at 4-2 if you pick Golden Remover?
Funny story, I actually asked Mort to add this to 4-2. I don't know if I was the reason. I asked in like the Discord they have with like people in the community. I was like, hey, can we add this to 4-2? And he's like, added me like a few hours later, added the 4-2.
Wait, I actually think I saw that. Let me see.
Because I don't know. I was just thinking like there's a lot of spots.
Yes, you actually did. You said add Golden Remover to 4-2, and then Mordok says I got you.
I mean, there's like a lot of spots where Golden Remover is like really, really good on 4-2. Like if you have like item holders you want to keep around, or if you have like TGs or something, it's a useful effect even like him. It's probably not the best on 4-2, just because one component relatively is less power as the game progresses. Probably say it's, I don't know if it's the lowest out of the three, like 2-1, 3-2, 4-2, but I don't think it's like the best average placement.
Yep, you're correct. It's basically the same. So the Golden Remover, it's just one of those things where it's just, if you are in a spot to take it and it can be useful, you should take it. But it's not like so good in the late game because it gives you all these options that you should be taking it very often, because the impact of that is can be kind of negligible at one point.
Like, as an aside, it's like one of my favorite effects they've added to the game in a while. It's so fun.
I love it. I hate it when there's specific things that happen. So there is a Janna encounter that gives Zephyrs. That is the worst. When someone has Golden Remover and there's just Zephyr, they're like, oh my god, here we go again. They just Zephyr cheese me. But not only is it great for min-maxing on item holders and whatnot, it's also just fun with like thieves gloves. You could like place the right thieves gloves in places. You can also slam your components, get cyber value without feeling like it's a sell you. It just feels good.
Yeah, I wish we saw more of them. Like, I wish there was like a gold augment that gave like two components or something. Like I don't know. I just want to play with this effect every game.
Interesting. So you're taking it a lot as a silver augment?
Well, I'm not necessarily taking it a lot, but I enjoy the times when I get to take it, play around it.
I see. Okay, fair enough. Last one for pop quiz. Lilia's targeting got changed this patch. As such, she has another best hex, and it's no longer the one just where it was before. So where is it now?
It's just a guess. I mean, it's probably just the corner, so I'm going to say like D7. I don't know. There's one game I put it in the middle to like dodge a Galen for a few rounds, and it was actually low-key popping off in the middle. So maybe it's the middle, but I'm just going to guess D7.
D7 is correct. D7 is now the best hex for Lilia because they did improve her targeting. But just very minimal, right? Like kind of like we're talking about, like basically along the back line, it ranged from 52 to 54, but D7 is like close to 55%. There is another secret hex where Lilia performs really well in, according to this team builder, that's not in the back row. Where would it be?
Oh, God. Is it like B7? I think I've like seen someone put it there before, like against me. But yeah. Is it like a secret tech?
I don't know if it's secret tech, but you are, again, spot on. How does he do it? 53.7% win rate at B7. B7, second row. All the way to the right, basically two hexes above the bottom right corner. That's where Lilia has a significantly higher win rate as well, relative to almost every other hex around it. Our thought.
I'm actually kind of surprised I got the right. I just like, there was like one person who did that against me. I don't know where else you would put her that's not in the back row. So.
Yeah, exactly. Like maybe C1, but yeah. That is a really interesting angle to think about when I'm playing Lilia. I definitely have to give that a try next time. Okay, let's wrap this up with Q&A. We had some questions from our viewers on Spotify and Discord. Make sure you guys submit for next episode as well. From Brent, he says, how do you find direction from a lower spot and being able to stabilize on stage 4?
It mostly just comes down to like, I mean, this is one of those hard questions. It just comes down to like evaluating like the strength of the lobby and recognizing your win con. For example, if there's like a lot of people with lots of inevitability, say like fortune cash out, greeting probably is incorrect. You probably want to play as aggressively as possible, try to high roll like a 2-star so you can save some HP. If the lobby is like relatively high tempo, maybe you go for like a greed play, maybe you level on 4 or 5 and try to gamble like hitting everything and trying to win out. Yeah, I don't know. I would just play it based off context.
Okay. My first thing that I would say is another tip for those situations is you just have to understand that you're playing for lower placement and maybe top 4 is on the table and you have to be a lot more aggressive. So you have to be willing to roll to 0. You have to be willing to spend your resources and slam your items. It's not necessarily about finding direction from a low roll spot. It's more about committing to a game plan that can play for placements and being aggressive about it. A player that actually does this really well in the past was Robin Songs. He's a person that has a reputation for actually overrolling a lot because an inside joke is that he's addicted to rolling. But part of the reason why that is because he's a person that rolled a lot on 7 because he realized that he needed to play for placements a lot. And that's why he had like a good top 4 rate. Because by rolling, he actually ends up discovering direction because he's just collecting pairs of what he thinks is strong and he's slamming his items. And that's how Robin oftentimes, like he was saying, he was playing for 5th, but he would squeeze out of 3rd and 4th just because he's better than a lot of the players he's in the lobby. And I think that for you, Brent, and players in that similar situation, you might find direction just by being aggressive, spending your resources, and stop thinking about trying to go to level 8 with max amount of gold. But just, you know, if you're in a spot to be able to have a lot of resources or in a spot to play more aggressive, just go for it. Okay, so next question from Vincent Mann. How do people study for TFT? You have normal players who may go by metacoms, but do pro study champs, items, and augments? And does knowing League of Legends make a difference in TFT?
I don't think you need to know League of Legends. Fun fact, I mean, not really that much of a fun fact. I really haven't played any league at all. I got into this
good
game
for you.
Through
congratulations.
I got it through TFT, through like Hearthstone and stuff, and through like IRL friends. So I don't really have any familiarity with League. You don't need that stuff. But for the first part of it, like how do you study? It just goes about for different players. Like for how I study, is I spend a lot of time in like the early part of the patches, like just studying the stats and like learning what comps are good. For example, like the current patch, or I mean, usually in the patch cycle, they release to other regions before they release to NA. So we got like a good like 12 hours to look at stats from other regions before it goes live. And I spent like 2 of that looking, saying like, oh, Ghostly Zyra is performing a lot better. Oh, Warden Cyber Ash is better. Lily is better. And then I kind of gotten like developed a game plan. Day one of the patch was to play like, that kind of stuff. But as like the patch develops, I'll stop focusing on stats that much and like start evaluating my own gameplay through like VOD reviews, through watching other people play, and like trying to understand like, should I pick this augment? What comp should I play here? What item should I slam?
Yep. I think that's great. Studying the game, studying stats, watching people. It's just like a mixture of everything. It feels like, for me, the same as learning a language. Funny, because people know TFT has like an accent, so it's almost like you're learning a different language. But it's about immersion. Studying TFT is a lot of surrounding yourself with it. That's kind of why people call it a no-lifers game. You don't really just like play TFT casually. If you do, you're probably playing like 4 or 6 hours and not really like pursuing. That's, people make jokes about that all the time. Studying TFT is like a mixture of everything. Playing, thinking, studying. I mean, sometimes I dream about TFT. Do you dream about TFT at all?
I dream about playing TFT, not like the actual game.
I mean, that counts. So, yeah. I mean, that's how much it's infiltrated our brains. And granted, Dishup's full-time TFT. I'm mostly full-time TFT. I have a normal job as well. But I do think that a lot of it is just integrating everything that you're describing. It's like everything you think and more. Talking about the game with friends is a big deal as well.
I guess it's just like a immersion critical mass kind of thing.
Yep. Okay. I think we have time for one more. So let's wrap it up with Riley's question, which is a first podcast picked up the Udyr positioning tip. Would love more positioning tips. Would love to see a pop quiz on every episode. Great. We have it back. Any more tips about backline access or positioning? I can go first on this one. There's a cool trick you can do with melee carries if you want to access the backline and they solo frontline a unit. Solo frontline being they have something in the front center like A4 and they have like stone plate And that's like a super tank, like, I don't know, like an Amumu 3 or something like that. And they're just relying on that unit alone to tank, and they backline everything else. There's a way you can kind of stack your melees to walk to the back line almost directly. I remember a player, Ripple Overdrive, did this in a tournament where he put Zed in the bottom right and put three other melees in front of him. So that way they would all wrap around the Amumu and Zed would just be forced to walk to the top right corner. And that's how he got onto a back line. I want to say like Ahri, like a KDA Ahri, and or a Caitlyn. And that's how he won the fight. That's actually a really cool way you can kind of manipulate and stack and punish people for just kind of positioning thoughtlessly and letting the solo frontline just try to absorb all their damage and they just get wrapped that way.
Here, I got a boring tip for you. Not as cool as sending your melee to the back with some 5-head positioning. But this one comes up like most games. It's like knowing whether or not you want to same side or enemy side if you're like both playing backline. Generally, the rule of thumb for this is if like your frontline is better than theirs, as in like your frontline will live longer than theirs, you always want the same side. So we see stuff like that with like high burst damage champions like Syndra. You basically always want the same side. But with Ashe, which takes time to do damage, she kind of ramps up. You pretty much always want to be opposite side. If like your frontline lives longer than them, you want to be same side, because what happens is you kill their frontline and then the next thing you're going to go onto is their backline.
I see. Yeah, because they walk up and then they target the top corner. Yeah, because that's the closest to them. Assuming you're playing bottom left, bottom right as well.
Yeah.
Oh, I like that. I don't think that was boring at all. I think that's actually a really good tip. All right. Just like that, we are done. Another episode in the books. How do you feel?
Feel good.
All right, great. So you got a couple of tournaments coming up. Actually, you're not playing this weekend, but you'll be playing in the next weekend, which will be really exciting. But we'll hopefully be able to do a podcast before that. Are you down to do it like next week as well?
Sure, yeah. Yeah, I can't wait to watch Day One Soju.
That's right. This weekend, we got the Tactician's Trials. That is the opening weekend before the finals weekend. You might know this formally as Day One of, you know, like KDA Hearthsteel Cup from Set 10. Or like a Dragon, Jade, Astral Cup, whatever. It's the day one of that. The people that made it through Ladder and Snapshots made it to day three. That's what Disope and Setsuko and what Soju used to do. But Soju will be playing, because he did not make Snapshots this time, he'll be playing in day one of the Tactician's Trials that start tomorrow. Okay, well, if you missed any part of this episode, you can always check things out over at our webpage, anchor.fm/TFT study hall. And thank you to everybody who is listening either on Spotify or another feed or through our homepage, tftacademy.com, where you can check out all the tier lists and educate yourself about TFT. And please, if you haven't already, make sure to give us 5 stars on the review for Spotify and either drop a question or just engage and follow it, because the algorithm does care. We're trending on leisure charts, which is really cool. I'd love to see more of that and just get TFT on the map, because if you look at some of the other podcasts on there, there's some heavy hitters there, and it's really cool to see a TFT community show up. So thank you all for the support, and we'll see you guys next time for more TFT action.
I'll see you guys later. Bye.